do you struggle with balancing combat and investigation in your RPGs? Monster of the Week offers a unique approach that can help. Tune in to learn how to keep your players engaged and entertained.
Hello and welcome, heroes, to Crit Academy, Dice and Dialogue. I am your host, Justin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your co-host, Alex.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon.
We are back with our second part of our Monster of the Week mini-series.
Yay.
I am super excited. Today we're going to be talking creating and running Monster of the Week campaigns. Now, some of this stuff you may recognize, as some of it is general to other RPGs, but there are certain things that stand out about Monster of the Week campaign development.
Correct.
And we're going to discuss much of that today. Now, it is worth noting that we are not experts on Monster of the Week specifically, but we are experts at game design and campaign design. Well, for those of us that design in advance... I'm very interested. There's a typical hierarchy in process that follows good storytelling, especially mystery style, which Monster of the Week very much falls into that sort of category. So before we get into the details of what sets that structure, I'd like to kind of hear what each of the game masters here do when they are designing a good campaign, specifically one that's for Monster of the Week, where the idea is that it's all ran in a single session.
Admittedly, the majority of the time when I have ran campaigns, I often, just because I only have so much prep time in the real world, will take a pre-existing adventure and read through it multiple times, maybe write down relevant stats for monsters on note cards, put them on a sheet of paper, and so on and so forth, and just get ready to go with that. But that's not necessarily an approach that would necessarily fit Monster of the Week as is, but we'll get more to that as the episode progresses.
Good.
How would I prepare? Well, I don't. So how would I go about for Monster of the Week? Well, Monster of the Week is episodic, as we have mentioned in the last episode. So I think I would find a random cryptid and base it off of that.
Monster.
A random cryptid?
A cryptid is
a... You don't know about cryptids?
It is a monster that is particular in urban legends of every state. Every state has a cryptid, generally. Like the Bertram Beast.
Or the Michigan Dog...
Mothman?
Or the Michigan Dog Man.
Okay. I didn't know that that's what it was called.
Nessie is considered a cryptid.
Sasquatch? Jersey Devil?
Yes. Huh. The Chupacabra?
I know what a hell a monster is. I didn't know that they were called cryptids. They're
called cryptids. So I take one of them because this is based in, what, was it 1986? Out of Oregon?
By default, yes.
By default. Well, what a perfect place than here to be able to just take a monster that's an urban legend that already exists and, like, all right, I'm going to take that. Just
pull from it.
Throw that right in here.
It's really good. I like that. Alex?
I think the number one thing I would do differently from any other campaign, because I don't really reference things. I don't really put references in my campaign. Like, I put little references, but I don't, like, steal plot from other places. I think this is the one place where I would make, like, a Google sheet that is, like, a questionnaire and be, like, and put the cult classics and be, like, what have you seen? How did you like it? Rate it, you know, 1 through 10. Mm-hmm. Rate each one of these 1 through 10, and then see the ones that nobody has seen before, and maybe like try to pull from there. Because I was thinking about like running stuff, and I just realized I could. This is gonna age me. I could run Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer as the villain, and like totally acceptable. Totally acceptable.
That's interesting.
I can make him shirtless all the time. And it's totally acceptable.
He's shirtless, huh?
Now I recall one time where I once ran a session of Icons, and I totally ripped off the plots for that session from an episode of A Big Guy and Rusty from the 90s.
That's amazing.
I know.
But yeah, but like that kind of stuff is like literally not only like cool to do, but it's kind of sanctioned by the writing because they literally reference like Supernatural and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and all of these things in the players in the playbooks.
Yep.
So that would be my number one thing that I would do differently. I would pull from pop culture.
Yep.
That's a
and I would definitely send a survey out.
Or take a movie that's not supernatural in nature and bend it in a way where it becomes that.
That's a good idea. That's cool. Yeah. I like that.
Honestly, it's kind of like how, like, for Marvel movies, what people generally consider to be, like, the best Marvel movies, they take a pre-existing template and then they kind of shoehorn the superheroes into it, not the other way around. Like, mm-hmm. Ant-Man, for example, mm-hmm. was a heist film first before yes. it was a superhero film.
And I think having that sort of vision is a key element.
Yeah.
So,
or like, now think about one time in the Little Witch Academia where they like break into a dragon's hideout, expecting to find a massive hoard. Like, where's your piles of gold? Gold? I don't use gold. That's old fashioned. I modernize. Snap his fingers. It's like big screen televisions flip up all over the place with stock market numbers scrolling across them.
That's a really cool way to do that. I like that.
But so you can use something like that, for example, to adapt to Wolf of Wall Street, but then replace the stockbrokers with dragons and so forth.
Oh, that's awesome. That needs to be a book. Somebody make that happen. We're writers. We can do that. So for me, there's a lot that goes into making a good campaign. I'm very much of the... bullet point format, and I like that because it's easily expandable. But
yeah.
to make a good campaign, you need a good structure to the story. So everyone knows you have to have a great setting. So deciding on the setting for a place like this, Monster of the Week gives you the good setting, which is Prospect, Virginia. Is that what it was? Prospect,
Oregon.
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 Which
Oregon
you don't Trail. Have to know anything about. All you have to know, it's very much along the lines of old 80s flicks, right? And that's kind of the setting you're put in. Now, nothing says you have to stay in that, but it sets the tone of the world that supernatural stuff is there, mm-hmm. but it's not common knowledge, right? So that's going to directly impact the characters and their players and how they handle stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not uncommon in like D&D for characters to go around town slicing up demons and monsters. But that's not as prevalent, right? So that's going to create some noise. It's going to create some unintended side effects, like mm-hmm. rolling really low and somebody think you're hurting somebody while you're fighting a monster and the cops get called on you.
Mm-hmm.
Blood everywhere, but the monster got away, right?
Yep.
Ooh. So the setting is very important to the tone.
Officer, do not panic. This is not my blood. That made it sound way worse.
So once you've decided, you've got the setting, and make sure the character, you want to share that knowledge with the players, make sure they understand the setting, because that's going to drive what actions they take and things that they do. Like, for instance, I mentioned in the last episode that my character used a Polaroid camera. I only chose the Polaroid camera because it was something in that era, something in that time frame, yeah. in that setting.
Yep.
If I hadn't known that, I would have easily said a phone,
yep.
right? Because that's what we do. We have phones now that take pictures. So the key to getting a good campaign together is first making sure that it's clear what is the setting, right?
Now think about the few times I've been in my fantasy settings. Oh, I know all this about vampires. No, you don't. Yes, I do. Look it up on my phone. End game.
End game.
So the way to solve that is is only half true, right?
Yep.
So that is a problem that happens in a place like futuristic stuff, right?
Yep.
Is that information is readily available. Yep.
Why do you think so many horror movies take place in the middle of the woods in the dead zone?
So what you can do is leverage it that the information is only partially right or half right.
Yep.
So now that you've done the setting, you need to decide on the plot. And the plot can be as simple as the prince has been kidnapped and three girls that work for Charles need to go rescue him.
Yep.
Right? That could be the overarching plot. What?
You know,
nothing.
You've seen the movie Cabin in the Woods, right?
No.
Anyway.
What?
I've not seen Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, God, you need to.
I don't do horror, typically.
You're going to get stuck.
It's okay, I haven't either.
Okay, even if you don't like horror, this is a horror movie to watch because it parodies horror movies so hardcore by being the perfect horror movie. But anyway, one of the gimmicks I had in there is when the teenager is walking through the basement, there's like random items all over And depending on which items they interacted with, it changed what the haunt was.
That's interesting.
They always had the conch shell. That's not fair.
Right. So I could easily see somebody taking that approach by placing miscellaneous items around when the players walk into the main setting.
That's a really good idea.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And when they interact with us, triggers what they're dealing with that week.
Okay.
Or took.
Since you're not going to watch this movie, I'm just going to that. Spoiler alert. Okay, so.
For a 2002 movie.
Yeah, like I said, all these teenagers go in this cabin in the middle of the woods, and they go into the basement. Junk everywhere. Trinkets. There is a secret, hive of scientists underneath the mountain.
Yeah.
And they're watching them, and they're putting bets on what they're going to pull and how long they're going to live and stuff. And then they pull some items and say, oh, damn, they didn't go for the conch shell, which was like a mermaid. A mermaid. That was going to attack them. Instead, it was something different.
Yep.
I can't remember what it was.
So are all the monsters like animatronic or something?
No, all the monsters are real monsters that the scientists have created, and then they let them loose depending on what they pull from the basement.
Oh, all right. So anyways, so you've got the plot.
Hold up. Why did I win the bet? I also bet zombies. No. You bet zombies. The winner was zombie lumberjack family. Completely different animal. Like Elvin Elvinseal.
So once you've got the setting and the plot, you have to structure the plot in a way that is going to follow great storytelling. And there's a lot of data out there that you can look at. But the big one is the conflict.
Yes.
The rising action. Mm-hmm. I recommend a twist.
Yep.
A climax and a resolution. Now, the only ones that really need to be in a certain order are the rising action, the climax, and the resolution. They need to fall in that sequential order.
Yeah, sure. But you can climax put stuff, first.
You can put stuff in between, however you want. And I think that really is core. And you can do that all on a single pad of paper with bullet points, right?
Yep.
Does anybody have any comments on that? Go ahead.
I also think that this would be the perfect time to bring up when you are preparing a Monster of the Week campaign, specifically a Monster of the Week,
mm-hmm.
They actually say in the book itself, they say that you should not prep anything previous to coming in to the game. And the reason why is because the game is highly, highly dependent on what your characters choose in their playbook. And so while you want to have these things of a rising action and the climax and all that stuff, and it's good to have that, it's also good to not railroad. Like if you railroad yourself, you're not going to have a good time. Like, no, this is not a railroady kind of game. I think that it's good to – what I would personally do with this is bullet points.
Right.
I would have bullet points of monsters that I think are really cool things about those monsters that I think are cool. How many times can I say cool in one sentence? And then I think I would also have bullet points of maybe people in town that they could run into just so I can pull someone out of a hat.
Right.
Maybe a general understanding of the city, but that's about all that I would pre-prep before I meet my players or my characters, I should say.
Yeah, I can easily see myself going, okay, I want to deal with this type of monster this week. Here's what triggers the events in theory. Okay, all right, monster effects, what their weaknesses are, what they're strong against, and let's pick, see how well they do in their investigation. One true fact, one half-true fact. No, actually, two half-true facts. And one that's blatantly false.
I like that. That's a really, really good approach.
Mm. Yep. Sir, I just stuck the vampires, but it's not dead. You're supposed to use hickory wood. Dang it!
So I do want to point out to Alex's point that when I mentioned the rising, the climax, you don't have to have that stuff defined in advance.
No.
You just want to make sure that you include the rising action, the climax, and the resolution and the twist as part of the experience.
Definitely.
Yeah, I also think on the keeper side, you can probably put everything you need to prep on the note card.
And go I would agree with that. For this game, absolutely.
Yeah.
So outside of the compelling story that you have to shape and build as you go, interesting NPCs are critical.
Yep.
If the people that are surrounding, that the characters are interacting with, aren't interesting, it's not going to be as engaging as you would like it to be. And the reason I say that is because the game is heavily, heavily, heavily driven by player agency, which means they have to have things to interact with,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a fleshed out NPC who seems suspicious, because you've all seen the shows, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's somebody who's like, oh, right at the bat, it's like, oh, that guy looks guilty as hell. Well, that's on purpose, right?
Yep.
That's on purpose. And so having, even if you create an NPC on the fly, decide at that moment a core feature about it that's physical, it's a mannerism, and a motivation. Those three simple things, if you make those up on the fly and stick to them, it creates a memorable character in your story.
The suspicious kid.
I mean, whenever you think about it, like, the reason why Maddie was shaped the way that she was shaped was
because she shapeshifts.
No, it was only because Jack decided that the NPC that worked the diner was the same, was a teenager like her. So she felt, so I was like, oh, she has a, like, there's a shot. And so using those descriptor words, I'm severely dyslexic, like extremely dyslexic. And so sometimes words, I don't have a very big vocabulary. And this is definitely one of those games where I would probably like make a list of really cool descriptors, mm-hmm. like extraterrestrial and like things like that. And I would have a list of descriptors, but I mean, this is with me and my learning disability, but I would have a list of descriptors that are very interesting and fascinating and like, oh, extraterrestrial, like stuff like that.
Right.
The epiphany was, what if, like, for example, when we walked into like the diner, we, and you're like, that old man's suspicious. But the twist was the old man was actually not the villain, but actually a good guy. And his whole thing was he actually was a blood runner, if you will, for an underground blood trade for vampires to keep them all in check.
Oh, and it was stalking her because she drinks blood?
No.
He just happened to be there.
He just happened to be there.
I like it. Because then that means if the players take interest in that particular character,
yep.
You've already defined what you're going to do with it instead of trying to think on your toes.
Right. And back to the maybe put two or three NPCs in there, and which one, once the players start to interact with, kind of triggers what the adventure is going to be.
Yeah. Like, I think in the one we were in, we didn't, there was really only three NPCs, I think, really.
Yeah.
One's the cook that.
You didn't really do much, to be honest.
I connected the dot. Well, when I connected the dots, he wasn't important, right?
Right.
And then there was Leslie, and then there was the dude with the sideways eyelids, which he didn't actually have. That's just, you know, the paranoid dude's kind of thoughts of what he saw. It could have been just glare off his, you know, binoculars or whatever. But you want to make sure that you're making interesting characters so that when the players hook on to them, you've already decided what that character is going to do or be, or how they're going to be tied to the story.
Yep.
The better you do that, the more flowing your story is going to be. Do you have any thoughts, Brandon, on that topic before we move on?
Nope.
Okay. So the other thing, and I think for Monster of the Week, this is actually really kind of what Brandon talked to. Designing monsters isn't nearly as complex as it is in other RPGs, but I also think that means that we can be more ambiguous with some of their abilities. And I want to use our example in ours of the goblin or the gerblin or the gremlin or whatever the hell it was.
If anything, it's fairly bare bones.
Yeah. So I know that it's bestial after we inspected it, right? We talked to it.
Yep.
I don't know if Jack already knew that's what he was going for or if it was decided in that moment. But in either case, because it was bestial, we just couldn't directly reason with it. We knew that it could go invisible. We knew it can make other things go invisible. We knew that light was the trigger for that invisibility. So the question is what other abilities could we build on the longer the adventure goes on based mm-hmm. around that concept?
Okay. Ooh. Or if we want the vampire angle, yeah, I keep bringing it up, just because there's so many things you can do with it. What kind of vampire?
What?
He's Danguinarian.
So, because
different vampires have different weaknesses and different like things they feed off of. So,
like maybe the whole garlic and cross and stuff is different like breeds.
Yep, that's interesting.
It's just like,
what?
Dude, that's the Eastern European vampires. I'm South American.
You bring up a clove of garlic and the girl's like, ah, I'm like, oh, I'm Jewish.
I think it would be really interesting that, realizing that the gremlin has, like, brothers and sisters. I think that's what I would do with it if I was to continue this on and make it, like, multiple sessions. I would make it to where the gremlin has brothers and sisters that steal other objects. So, like, somebody else steals, like, electric things, and somebody else, like, steals. The thing that I mostly think about is, like, a gremlin that steals things that smell really good. So, like, weird stuff that goes missing, like shampoo and candles and, like, all that kind of stuff goes missing.
It smells flowery in here. I don't think I like it.
I think that's how I would build off of it, and I think that's how I would keep it. It's like, okay, so each, and then it's like, okay, so each gremlin picks a thing. Each gremlin picks a thing that they're obsessed with, and then they hoard that thing. And then it's like, oh, there's more to the storyline.
Or one thing angle that Jack could have taken too was, let's say we did what we expected me to do, and I smited that goblin, gremlin, whatever, when we pulled it out into the alley. But then I could easily picture someone going, and suddenly you see a bunch of red eyes when you open in the shadows.
Oh, no.
Oh, crap.
I just came up with an interesting concept with that. It's just saying, what if there's like a goblin that steals things that smell good? What if there's a goblin that steals things that smell bad? And it puts its hoard like within like a police station or something like that. And it just gradually starts stinking really, really bad. And they're like, where is that coming from? Like, I don't know.
Did Billy leave the donuts in the sun again?
Ew.
So the one thing, and I kind of want to expand upon the idea of the monster, was I was really intrigued on what was happening with the loot. Mm-hmm. It's going invisible. So immediately in my mind, this is an alien creature that's sent to other places because their home is stuck between dimensions. And the only way that they can get anything that they can need, whether it's a chair or a table or something like that, is to touch it and have it enter into this like phasing thing. So there's an alien home somewhere of these little gremlins where they just have chairs and tables and stuff occasionally when it's night out on Earth, right? And their stuff just disappears all the time, and that's what they're doing. They're scavenging things to survive, right? And it teleports between these two dimensions depending on the time of day.
Yeah.
And so their whole entire civilization is based on, we can't get resources here. We have to go find them elsewhere. So they send out these little menacing gremlins. Not menacing, innocent gremlins that are just out trying to gather things that they need. Perhaps all the things that were disappearing, maybe the watch they took is they needed a way to catch time. So he's looking for watches and, oh, I want to dress nice. Here's some cufflinks. I don't know. But to me, that's an interesting aspect that if I was to continue on Monster of the Week, having that come back up and having the players learn more about that monster of itself, right?
Yep.
And I just think that that's fancy.
I also like that because it poses a moral dilemma, and I love moral dilemmas.
Yep.
Like, what do you do? Like, these things are trapped in this area, and they need items. Like, they need food. They need stuff to survive, but, like, they're stealing. So, like, what do you do at that point? I think that would be a very fun moral dilemma to pose to people.
Yeah, of course. Oof. I would go the moral route because that's kind of how I always do. Yeah. So there's kind of a lot to that. Is there anything else on designing the monsters that we really want to touch on? Because for me, there's a lot of sources out there, but I think you come up with a theme and stick with it, and then just expand upon the same theme.
Yep.
Because a Monster of the Week is not as well defined as other stat blocks, I think that gives you a lot of wiggle room to play with as the game master.
I would say for the most part, simply put, maybe put puzzle pieces in place, and depending on what the monster is, the more puzzle pieces the players discover, the higher their modifiers are against the monster when they engage it.
Ooh, so they get rewarded for investigating more details and uncovering the secrets?
Like, for example, you take a regular werewolf, for example, through mundane means, it does jack squat, but once you find, like, silver, for example, then you can actually harm it.
Right, right.
and so forth. Or you can hurt like a vampire, but it doesn't slow it down, but once you find like wooden stakes and stuff.
And actually, to jump off of that, you can even build that around the story, right?
Yep.
Let's use the werewolf, for instance. We know that silver is important. In the gremlin, we know light is important. That becomes a key aspect of where these things would hang out.
Yep.
Right? Choosing a dark bar, probably not a good place for a gremlin that makes things disappear only in light. Right?
I remember I pitched the idea of like find a abandoned gold mine somewhere and mm-hmm. just let it loose there where it's harmless.
It's like one of those dive bars like on the side of the, hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Where the light's very dim.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you got patrons that are like, I swear I see there's money in that corner, but I don't know.
Like they can't tell if they're just drinking or on drugs.
It's
or just
not dark enough, but it's not light enough. So it's like...
It's just kind of bouncing in and out. Maybe somebody opens the door for an instant and it pops up and then it shuts and it's gone.
Now think about one episode of Supernatural where the monster can only be seen if you're intoxicated.
Oh, that's hilarious. but I think...
It wouldn't be too hard to...
I think the narrative focus of this gives us something as... game masters to really clamp onto and include those little details in the thought process as we're generating the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think Jack did a really good job with the light because it threw my ass off the whole time, but it ended up working. It's very good. What about balancing of combat versus investigation?
For the most part, I think we firmly established that even though it's there, this is not a very combat-heavy game.
Mm-hmm.
That said, that doesn't mean you can't implement both in way, shape, or form, and I think it does in the end depend on your group, everyone's playstyle slash the keeper's playstyle.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, if everyone's very much into the combat, you can do a giant, you know, killer Santa Claus, and they have to go in and bust up a house and find out that not only is the killer Santa Claus real, but it was summoned here by some crazy people, right? Go in and bust that up, and then what are you going to do with them? Summon him again. Was his name Krampus?
Krampus.
Nothing but the movie, the Norwegian movie Troll Hunter. That was pretty good.
Okay.
And Billy next door got more presents than me. Come here and take his family out.
So
I would definitely say that whenever it comes to the balance of combat, this is really, really light on the combat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is one of those where I would definitely equate the combat to cilantro, where it's just like, it's there. It's there. Yeah, but essentially, I actually ran into someone at a convention that I was at, who has played Monster of the Week, and when you do combat over and over and over again, whenever you do a lot of combat in Monster of the Week, it ends up making you have very very quickly you start making a lot of rolls, right? So very quickly you start gaining XP.
Mm-hmm.
But then whenever you gain so much XP, then it's like, okay, well then what's like the point of playing? The game is not designed to have a lot of combat.
Yeah.
The whole game is not designed like that.
Also worth noting too though, that if you have a lot of combat, you would gain harm very, very quickly. Unless you start bringing through luck and we touched on last episode, that can bring its own share of problems.
Right. I agree quite a bit, and I think because of that, you have to focus big on the lore and the investigation and roleplay aspect. So, a good example...
Pitch Black.
What?
Riddick.
Riddick movie?
Yeah. Because remember how, for the most part, they could actually fight the creatures? They had to ward them off using light?
Yes.
And that was an ongoing resource they had to worry about throughout the entire film?
Mm-hmm.
So, picture a dice counting down.
Yep, the countdown. They got that in this game.
We didn't
use it, but yeah. So that's a really good point. So in order to fully understand and deal with the monster, they need to research. We see this a lot in things like Supernatural, where they're trying to learn and build up what is the weakness of this creature, blah, blah, blah. How do we defeat it? How do we kill it? Blah, blah, blah. So a lot of it comes down to that focus that leads into the climax. And if they make one bad roll, that leads to misinformation to find out that no, vampires aren't allergic to garlic. They're allergic to onions. But that's going to make a hell of a difference when you go to fight it because now you're dead. And that's why everyone thinks it's garlic, because the one person that got it right either didn't share it or maybe nobody ever got it right. That was a lie spread by the vampires through their newsprint presses that they're allergic to, you know, garlic.
Look, man, I assume that because the lore said garlic and they had the Supreme Pizza, And the guy ran away from me because I was holding it. I made assumptions. I think most of the onions on the pizza.
Like that. There's a cute example of that in this anime I used to watch a while ago called Karen. The manga's called Chibi Vampire. It's about a vampire who's a reverse vampire. She produces too much blood. And when she gets to be too much, just massive nosebleed. That's her issue. But she can feed on people and it suppresses that. So she gets a human boyfriend and she wants to invite him over for dinner so she can cook for him. And she brings up all these cloves of garlic and their parents are real vampires. Like, what are you doing? It's like, well, I just, what, do you think this would be good? It's like, yeah, fine, just get it out of here. And then she leaves. Like, ah, you know, we're not actually allergic to that shit. It just smells really bad.
And I have seen some shows and books that have done that angle too.
We're not allergic to
garlic. But I think for this, and I'd like to hear Alex's, in order to really make that work, you need to focus on those aspects of it, and that those roles during those investigations and those educational period should determine the difficulty of the encounter at the end. Because in my opinion, a series of bad roles could and should lead to a situation where the player characters can't defeat the monster.
Yep.
So the resource, they're like in Pitch Black, they have to now either just run away and avoid or lead it into a trap, capture and contain.
Mm-hmm.
They can't just slay it. So, Alex, did you have anything on that?
I definitely agree with you. I think that it would be really, this is a game that is made to be punished for bad roles. I mean, like we said in the last episode, if you fail a role, like fail a role, not only does it not work, but you give something up. Because something breaks or you give up a piece of information or something like that happens. And so I think this is very much a place where actions have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I agree with you.
And it is worth noting too, that one thing we did come up in discussion is there's no initiative.
Yes.
No.
For combat. It's all so narrative driven that whether you get harm or not depends on your dice rolls too.
Yep.
Huh. And wasn't it you, Alex, who said you saw a game where, like, there's a monster? Okay, we all draw our pistols. Bang, 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 bang. We win.
Yeah, it ends up becoming really unenjoyable.
That's rough.
Yep.
Okay, they all did enough harm. Turns out this was just its first form.
Yes. If all goes south, give it a second form. Yep.
Now think about in the Dresden Files, how they make a point repeatedly, like, yeah, humans are technically on the bottom end of the food chain because they're not really that powerful compared to a bunch of supernatural creatures. But the thing they have going for them is numbers. And in modern times in particular, those big numbers have guns and that adds up very fast. And you actually saw that in later books when open warfare.
I needed to pick those up. I saw the TV show that they had for a short while, which I liked, but they ended.
I will say this, though. The TV show was not at all...
accurate?
No.
I'll check it out. You keep talking about
it. To what now?
Bob's...
Dresden Files.
Like, Bob's supposed to be a skull, for example.
He was, except for he was also a ghost that popped it out.
But he never popped out in the book.
Oh, just a skull.
He just stayed in the skull.
Anyways, so, when it comes to running the balance of the lore and exploration pillars, that's your opportunity to feed off of the random thoughts that the players have. Mm-hmm. Ian keeps bringing up vampires. We know that players themselves know the lore of vampires mm-hmm. being weak to garlic and crosses and stakes yep. and blah, 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 blah. So you expect some of that to come in. And so having them go to find that information and confirm it, yeah. Well, yeah, it's alert. The stake through the heart will kill him, but only if it's made of redwood. So you can expand on that without really pulling away from it if you want, and completely.
And since I keep using vampires as an example, and I keep mentioning the Dresden Files, in Dresden Files, there's multiple courts of vampires, and they're all different types from different regions. And they went out their way of saying everybody, when you think of a vampire, as actually think of a black court vampire. And that was because in their work as the vampires, the Wizards Council released Bram Stoker's Dracula, which they treated as a handbook on how to kill black court vampires. But which is why there's so few of them these days. But the weaknesses that the black court vampires have may not apply to just let's say red court or white court or jade court.
That's fascinating. I didn't know there were so many courts of vampires. I watched Blade. They all pretty much die by silver.
Yeah.
And there's actually UV lights.
That's one of the things I liked about the D&D vampire.
Yeah.
Is that driving a stake into its heart doesn't kill it. It just incapacitates it.
For a little while.
No, until it's removed.
Just puts it to sleep?
Yeah, it just...
Oh, that's awesome.
Stays there. That's it.
So what if somebody like stabs it, fills it, and pulls their stake back out for later? The thing just comes back alive and chokes a bitch.
That's pretty much what it's about.
You just answered your own question.
all right. So there's a couple of other things I want to talk about before we're coming to a close here.
Yeah.
And I want to hear everyone's opinion on how best to ensure you have good player engagement and agency. What are some advice you guys to help get players invested in the story and keep them and get invested in the monster and the story throughout the adventure?
I'm trying to think of some good tips that apply to this team specifically, but anything that comes to mind applies to just RPGs in general.
Well, that's okay.
Make sure the monster is screwing with them specifically.
Yep.
Give them a reason to want to go for the monster.
So they're the monster out hunting the hunters?
Yeah. Could be like that. Like what if this goblin stole something when you guys had?
Because
that would most definitely want you to find it.
But it was so like minor.
Yeah, because well, the goblin kept on harassing me because it was trying to shiny things, and my guy's a former businessman who still has lots of his items on him.
Right.
Son of a duck!
I think the biggest thing that I would want to get across to somebody else, if I was like telling somebody else how to play Monster of the Week, I think the biggest thing that I would get across is, in order to have the player action, everyone needs to have the same idea in mind. Are we doing Scooby-Doo, or are we doing more like Clue? Are we doing X-Files? Are people in danger? Like, I think that having the same vision across the board will be able to engage the players more and more, because they'll be invested in the vision because it's also their vision. Because you have to agree, there's a difference in between X-Files and Scooby-Doo, but yep. You can run both of those kinds of games in this system.
Right.
And so that's my biggest piece of advice whenever it comes to player engagement, is make sure that everyone's visions match. And that's definitely a day zero discussion to have. How I would facilitate that discussion, I think the way I would facilitate that discussion is give examples of like X-Files, Scooby-Doo, Clue, you know, things like that, and try to come to a resolution of, okay, we want mystery, but we actually want there to be danger, unlike Scooby-Doo, you know, and kind of create your own almost like template to put all of the rest of the campaign on.
Right. That's a good idea. I like that. One thing I would touch on is one of the greatest sources you're going to find for engaging your players is their character sheet.
Yep.
If you look at these and say, oh, Ian's character, Hugh, has lay on hands. I want to set up an opportunity for him to use that. He has soothe. I want to set up an opportunity for him to use that. Smite, cast out evil, angel wings. These are things that are on his character sheet that me as the keeper or game master, and really for any RPG, should be looking for opportunities to let that power shine.
And I do want worth to mention, at the very least, is that the mission I selected was preventing the apocalypse.
Yes.
That some angelic being appeared to me, bestowed power unto me, and saying, the wrong apocalypse is coming. Stop it. Wait, what do you mean the wrong apocalypse?
The wrong apocalypse. So that he beat me to it, but that was one of the other things. The character sheet has goals of the character, and you should be, as the keeper, trying to leverage that.
And not to mention, given ideas of how your characters know each other, can act as a springboard for how your characters can play off each other, too.
Right. What do you think, B?
That's so bad. There's an asteroid coming. It's not supposed to be. All right, we'll take care of it. Yeah, it's supposed to be a super volcano. What?
Do you have any player engagement tips?
Other than what you've covered, yep, pretty much it.
Okay.
That's what I do with my players.
Yep. Touch on their motivations, touch on the things that the players like.
Mm-hmm. I tell them, it's like, give me a backstory and I will feed into that.
Well, see, but in Monster of the Week, you don't need a backstory. It literally has two lines for your mission, right? Like,
that's a backstory. Mm-hmm.
You don't, this is a master class in game design.
Yeah.
Right? It's simple, it's to the point, and it gives you so much to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Get, or Or the other thing, too, is I know one tip we've touched on in the past it is, especially in a game like this that's very narrative driven, you might play the GM might describe the scene, the players might describe where they are, and you could go, you, since you're there, you notice this. How do you react?
That's a good approach. That's a like a yes and, but
yeah,
directly at them.
Mm-hmm.
So I like
and
that.
Having players tell you where they're at, what a place looks like. You had brought that up once. It's like you walk into the diner. What's the diner look like? You. What do you see when you enter? Yeah, tell me. And that wraps their environment into their own mind.
That's one of my favorite Game Master tips and works very, very well in Monster. Well, it works very well in general, but in Monster of the Week, that encourages less prep. Turning and asking a player to fill out what does the dark alley look like? What are some things that stand out? Let them set the scene. They're doing most of the work for you. Mm-hmm. And since I'm lazy, I like to make them do all the work.
Yeah, so. If they're bad at improv, just give them time.
Yeah, just takes practice. I mean, you say it's an alley. Okay, is it dark? Is it light? Does it got a trash can? Yep. Does there a guy, a shadowy figure it's in the back? You know, what do you say?
Several shadowy
figures. Are you going to hide in the trash can,
I would.
Justin, are you going to hide in the trash can?
Well, no, they'd hear it. I'd hide behind it. Then hit him with a foreign object! Anyways, so overall, there's a lot that can go into the campaign design. But the core takeaways are have a session zero or talk before the game about what type of game you want to play, discuss the setting, come up with some sort of general plot, a rising action, a climax, definitely a twist. Twists are good. One of my favorites.
More than one twist.
Right. One of my favorites is when we were doing a quest for somebody. And it turned out that it was a polymorphed beholder who was stuck and needed the object to return himself to normal. So we did something good by helping somebody, but destroyed the city in the process because we turned loose a crime lord on him. So plots or twists are really great too. So look for those opportunities. I think a last note would be to, if you're going to do an episodic, try hinting at an overarching plot. I think Ian gave us a great example of the wrong ending world event is coming. So tying that into the gremlins are showing up because the world's going to end and are going to lose all the resources that they have access to. So they're trying to grab as much as they can. So now it's not just a contained thing. It's something happening worldwide. So
now here is our Unearthed Tips and Tricks system agnostic content for your tabletop RPG game.
Our encounter is hidden in plain sight, and I really like this one, so hope you guys are ready. So the characters are basically approached by a wealthy collector of exotic creatures who are offering a significant reward for a unique mutated Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Ooh.
And the reason they're interested in it is because it's said that its scales give off brilliant and rainbow bright colors. And so as a collector, he hopes to show it off and sell the view to the people. But it's a T-Rex. They're big. They're scary. They're dangerous. But there's a twist.
Does that have to do with the rainbow scales?
It does.
Oh, yes.
It's not a Tarrasc, is it?
No.
Okay.
The information that he's gathered about it being different colors is kind of accurate. But not, it's only half true. It actually has chameleon-like scales that change color to blend into its surroundings. Like a chameleon.
Camorex?
Yes. Yep. And then the hunt begins. Now, the characters don't know this. In this, I envision the part of the journey is the more information and research they do, the more stories they collect, the more they can connect the dots. But if they just go after it, they're going to get ambushed by a 30-foot-tall dinosaur.
Clever go.
What do you guys think about this?
I think that it should also have advantage on hiding in plain sight when it tries to run away.
Of course.
It's like, oh, they're attacking me.
Well. Doesn't say what the stats are, right? You can do whatever you want with it.
Yep. Was this taken from, like, Jurassic World?
No.
Indominus Rex from Jurassic World?
Indominus Rex from Jurassic World.
No, actually, Bloody Roar.
Oh.
Bloody Roar.
It's an old PlayStation fighting game. Yeah, the guy's a giant chameleon, goes invisible in plain sight.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, fuck you.
I remember also, that. I remember
everything about that.
I think there was an adventure I ran previously in Savage Counters that had a monster that was like a raptor that did the same thing.
Cloaking Raptors, great.
Justin, I like that,
they're not going to see it coming.
I'd really hate to burst your bubble, but you and I know damn well that no one is going to give this dinosaur over to that man. They are going to take one look at this dinosaur and try to keep it as a pet. You know this. We both know this.
I'm going to cast Animal Friendship. Fuck!
They're going to cast Minimize on it or something like that.
What is wrong with your chameleon?
Don't worry about it.
The T stands.
It's got
tiny.
Stubby legs.
But you and I both know that this goddamn dinosaur is gonna become a pet.
Well, remember, it's still gonna. It's brutal. So everyone's got that douchey little pet that bites them all the time.
Although my rebuttal: am I the player in that party?
Sure, why not?
Kill it with fire.
Kill it with fire. Overall, do you think that this would be a fun and engaging encounter?
Oh yeah,
yes. So fun.
Do you think the players would expect it?
God, no.
No.
Because, you know, what kind of creature that's 30 foot tall can go invisible-ish? And no, I think it's cool because the whole thing alludes to its ability. Its color, its rainbow coloring scales. And you can have rumors tossed in that talk about, you said it was red. I thought it was like a blue. And that's where the whole thing comes from, is people that have seen, quote unquote, this thing stomping in the distance come up with different colors that they've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And that alludes to the fact that its scales change colors. And so this becomes the success of this mission 100% relies on their ability to investigate and learn more before they hunt. Otherwise, this is just an opinion, this thing should ambush them, advantage on the attack, and they're gone. Yeah, and then it runs away because it's full.
I thought it was orange. Only when it's running across mountaintops at dusk.
Oh, that's a good one. See, those are the type of clues you want, right? Because that's clearly a clue. And that's where this whole idea comes from.
What color does it turn whenever it's aggressive? Because whenever chameleons are aggressive, they turn red. They turn like a specific color. So what?
Maybe it turns into a regular scale color.
What if it turns rainbow? To be like red? So the only time this dude's ever seen it is whenever it's pissed off because it saw this man.
Maybe. Feel the LGBT wrath.
Get out of my territory.
Start shimmering.
I think you can do a lot with it, though.
You said rainbow scales. My first thought was Tarrasque because of a reflective carapace.
Yep.
That's what my thought was.
Tarrasques are as big as a mountain. Though,
yeah, so. They're quite large. That's why I was confused.
And you can change it from a T-Rex to something else. But to me, the play on the T-Rex and the chameleon was fun.
Pachyraptors.
You have to make it a T-Rex because they're going to adopt it.
They can try.
I mean, the T-Rex, they can try to adopt. But if it's a raptor, they're just going to like gag it and go. Like, they're not. Yeah. They'll try later.
I've had a player once try to adopt a slod, which I want to point out are... The D&D equivalent to xenomorphs is in the fact that they reproduce by shoving a seed inside you, which then bursts out of your chest.
Isn't that how everything reproduces? By shoving a seed inside something?
And then it bursts out of your chest?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's a different one.
Chest burster.
All right,
my players ruined my game with this because they fought two T-Rexes. They polymorphed them into sheep and a sheep and a frog. And because they had that stat block, it made it easier to animal friendship with them.
Yeah,
and then they just stayed that way. I was like, "Well, fuck. Okay, great. Thanks, guys."
I think
so. I didn't want them to have two, so they got attacked by a purple worm, which ate one, and then it ran away. It's like, okay, you get one.
I think there's conditions on that though, unless it's true polymorph. Was it true polymorph?
No.
Okay, makes a difference. Ooh,
polymorph into a squirrel, and then hit it with flesh to stone.
So the real question is, for this to work, to turn it to stone, to make it a statue, I was going to ask, how would your characters transport it? Assuming you have a wizard turning it to a squirrel, then turning its flesh to stone, and carrying a tiny chameleon T-Rex with you. Yeah, sure. Okay. If you didn't have magic, how would you get this thing to the collector? Assuming they don't animal hug on it.
If it was the I&I group.
Tranquilizer.
if it was the INI group, they'd come up with some kind of sedative. They would do a dart thing. They would get a friend. If it was my Wednesday group, they'd write it. That's what they would try.
They just write it back to him. All right, where do you want it? Right there, Betsy.
Squandered.
Carry these stakes. Now run.
Squander the taxpayers' dollars. Yeah, I can't. You guys can't get them a graboid to swallow this, but for $50, I can get them to swallow this. It's a car.
All right, so I think that'll do it for our encounter, hidden in plain sight.
I like that.
The
one.
Only That's thing good. I would add to this is lots of other potential encounter concepts.
There's two of them.
It's leftovers, for instance, right? They find something that looks like it was ambushed. There's no tracks to it. Maybe it climbed up the side of a rock and jumped down on top. You know, there's no tracks leading to the carcass, but leading away, showing that it's an ambush creature.
Someone's
adding difficult
it.
Terrain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot you could do with that. Good luck. So our magic item today is the chameleon coil. Jeez, Justin, how did you ever come up with such an idea?
Wow, Justin, that's amazing.
So I always like the idea of invisibility. There's magic and stuff that does it. But I figured maybe we should come up with a way to better capture different creatures. Right now, we struggle. We focus so much on slaying monsters that we don't really give the players a good opportunity of capturing them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the chameleon coil is about a 50-foot long magical hempen rope. And it's woven with threads from green and brown to blend seamlessly into the natural surroundings.
Oh, what the hell?
When used to tie up a monster, for instance, it magically shrinks it.
Yeah, you gave the players a way to get the Rex.
I did.
Yep.
But it's not just for that. It's actually, I think it's beneficial in general. So they can tie it up. It's a rare item. It has an ability called monster binding, which when it's tied up around a beast, the chameleon coil automatically adjusts to the length and thickness needed to properly capture the creature. Now, it also comes with beast soothing, right?
Yes.
Which basically kind of relaxes and reduces the creatures from a frenzy or a rage, assuming the characters fail. But that can only be used once a day, but the effect lasts for 4 hours. Now, it also has chameleon camouflage, which means when you drop it onto the ground, it blends into whatever its surroundings are.
Ah, trap.
It's a trap.
That's not a trap.
I'm very simple with this, but I thought that this was something I haven't seen in D&D.
Mm.
And to me, that's fascinating because that means we're under the assumption that they're always going to kill everything. So we don't give them the tools to capture.
Yep.
I mean, hemp and rope, I guess, but that really isn't going to hold anything. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on this.
This definitely feels like it's filling a hole in D&D in particular. And just in more like slash and hacky kill games. This really feels like to me like, wow, I can find so many uses for that, which tells me that it was a hole that needed to be filled. So I think this is really good, actually. I think you did a really good job.
Yeah, it is worth noting that the color transformation can only be used once a day and only in last 24 hours. So if you place it in a forest and use it and then try to place it on some boulders, it's not going to work, right?
Yeah.
So there is some limitations and it requires a bit of strategy. Brandon, what do you think?
I hope my players still don't listen to this show. Because they're going to use that against me. So mother from mother be like, hey, is there a magic shop down? Yes. Do they have something called a chameleon coil? Motherfucker!
Okay, so is this something you would let in your guys' game?
Yeah, I'd let them.
You don't think it's too powerful?
You know what I actually think this would fit really well? I'm sorry, I just processed this. Numenera. This would be a really, really good Numenera item.
I would agree. Definitely fits more into that theme.
Also, yes, so, I would let this in my game.
So what changes would you make? Do you think it's too powerful? I mean, the DC save is 17. So for weaker monsters...
Well, depends on the game, of course, but like, if you made like a rare enough item, you're fine.
Yeah, this is rare. It is worth noting that it specifically details for beasts.
Yeah.
Right? And that is a category for monster, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work on everything as far as the calming mechanics and everything, but the invisible mechanic, using it as a trap and blending it in will work for any monster, right? Because at that point, it's just hemp and rope. But that goes invisible or goes stealthy, right? All right.
And the shrinking is neat. I gave my players one of that. Because after they got the Rex, they're like, well, you can't just walk through the city with a T-Rex. You're going to cause mass hysteria. So, you know what? Go to a magic shop. Maybe I've got something for you.
Oh.
And they have a collar that says Rex on it, and it you can shrink them down one size.
It doesn't shrink the monster, I don't think.
No.
It shrinks and grows the rope big enough or small enough to fit whatever it's on. So you're still dragging a giant T-Rex.
Okay.
But that's what the soothing is supposed to do in combination with, like, animal handling and speak with animals and all those things. This is to help, but it still requires some of the other skill sets. So
right. I'm trying to think of how long 50 feet is. I would actually probably make
it's
it 70.
Between 49 and 51.
You're thank smart-ass. You. I would probably make it 75 feet, especially if they were higher level, because they're going to be encountering larger monsters or perhaps want to take down like a Remoraz where they're going to have to like do a giant like multiple loops around legs or like try to like get its butt in its feet. You know what I mean? Like they're very interesting. Actually, like a Behar, is a Behar the one that has six arms?
Yes.
The ice guy that has six arms. You know, like I think if it was like higher levels, I would probably do 75 feet. But other than that, I wouldn't change it.
Although it does adjust in thickness and stuff too, so you could easily say,
yeah, you can just say that's part of its ability. I mean, already gross in thickness.
If you want a good representation of that, radio towers that are red and white with the alternating patterns.
Yeah,
Those alternating patterns are 100 feet each.
Why is it women always want to make things bigger? What?
What?
Why is it always about size?
I don't know.
Who cares? The hemp and rope can be as big as you want it to be. It's world of make-believe.
You asked.
Can't get the
I'm just giving you my information.
Huh? Anyway.
That you can't get to England in a rowboat.
So, that'll do it for our magic item, the chameleon coil. Yeah. Whether you want it 50 feet or 100 feet, it's part of its ability if you want it to be. I think that'll do it for this episode of Monster of the Week, how to build a Monster of the Week campaign. Please join us in 2 weeks as we'll be discussing advanced techniques and tips for mastering Monster of the Week. If you enjoy the show and you'd like to support us, visit us at critacademy.com, follow us on social media, visit our social media pages, because they don't share anything anymore unless you pay them Uko bucks, and we don't have that, and leave us a review.
Yep, be sure to like, subscribe, click on that bell, share, definitely share.
Yeah. I'm your host, Justin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your co-host, Alex.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon. Thanks for listening.
Have fun on your adventures, and don't be a dick!